Gut, dann wollen wir gleich zur Keynote übergehen und nicht länger auf die Folter spannen. Der Martin hat uns was Spannendes zu erzählen, den kennen wir ja schon von gestern Abend. Martin, please join us on stage. Martin Woodward. Und so a couple of things.
Yes, you're done. You're done.
Do my one first here because I have a small thing.
Yeah.
Thanks. So a couple of facts about Martin. You already told us yesterday that you were an MVP.
Yeah.
Former MVP. Uh-huh. And then you joined Microsoft.
Yep.
Apparently as the first official Microsoft employee that was supposed to build Java-based Eclipse plugins.
I was, the first Eclipse developer in the Visual Studio team. I didn't have many friends, so let's put it out.
and you had to come up probably with things like, you know, how do our Java coding guidelines at Microsoft look like and stuff?
Yeah,
isn't that weird?
It's great, and they're not, the documentation and standards is pretty sparse around that area, so it was good.
No, you call that agile,
even had,
right?
Agile, sorry. We even had, like, security tooling and all sorts that we have to put in place for the Java tools, and all that stuff got used now because, I don't know, we do quite a lot of Android investments and quite a lot of other stuff that's, we've been doing, so it's all paid off.
Nice. Yeah, it's kind of weird, and it really marked a new decade in Microsoft, like starting to do Java development and building Eclipse plugins.
It's been good. When I joined the company 5 years ago, people kept asking, you know, how's it going? It must be a strange sort of conversion over to Microsoft. And it's actually really strange because Microsoft seems to be coming closer to where I am. You know, I'd come from like an agile background, a cross-platform background, and I'm sat here going, okay, everyone seems to be going agile and going cross-platform. I'm just going to stay where I am.
Change Microsoft
teams.
They came to you. Nice. That could be a good start for your talk, right?
Yeah.
So I also heard that you're one of the only guys who actually realized that there's an airport code called TFS.
I've been trying to convince my wife for around about 10 years now to let us go on holiday to Tenerife. And she didn't understand why I wanted to go to Tenerife because she likes Mallorca, you know. And I was like, no, Tenerife's great. We should go to Tenerife. She said, no, Tenerife's terrible. It's got black sand. You can burn your feet. It's no good. No, Tenerife's fantastic. She eventually figured out this year it's because the airport code for Tenerife is TFS. And I just wanted that.
So if you're not sure we want to do your next vacation, just enter TFS into your favorite fly search engine.
It'll be fine.
And you'll find it, yeah.
We should have an offsite, Sam, shouldn't we?
TFS team offsite.
Yeah.
So last thing, because I always make fun of the many save icons and Team Web Access, I found this thing while reading Twitter. Not that I have a Twitter account, but could you comment on this one?
Yeah, so I have my office at home, and my children were rooting in my cupboard looking for some paper because they just run into my office and steal paper. And my six-year-old said, Daddy, I've just found some file save icons. Have you ever tried to use these? It's like you can't fit a presentation on it. It's 1.4 meg.
Not even an empty presentation.
No, yeah. Exactly. And they're so slow. It's unbelievable.
That were great times.
Yeah.
So, I think we introduced you well. So, thanks, Martin, and have fun telling us the Scaling Agile story.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So, good morning, everybody. As I say, my name's Martin Woodward, if you didn't know by now. We're going to talk about Agile at Microsoft. We've already covered a bit of it in some of the earlier sessions, you know, in some of the panel discussions. So, to jump to the punchline, there is no one way in Microsoft that Agile is done, and that's kind of the point. That's a deliberate thing. Agile, you should customize to your team. You should work based on the personalities and the constraints in your organization. This is a story about how we're doing it in developer division, which is the little area that Sam and Munil and I work in. So this is just our story. We have moved to now 3-week sprints. We do roughly Scrum at the team level, and we have a big emphasis on autonomy, on teams being responsible for their own direction within certain common standards and constraints, which we'll talk about. And it's important that the agile transition in Microsoft was driven, it began as a bottom-up movement in Microsoft, where people were being agile and experimenting with agile ways of working within teams. But where we've had the best success is as it's come from the top down as well and kind of met in the middle. that we've made some big changes to the way our environment works at Microsoft, to the way we structure our business in Microsoft, so we can be more agile. And only those changes happen when your leadership believe in becoming more agile and empowering teams. You know, managers don't like to give up power very often. And good managers love to give up power, because good managers like to hire people smarter than them. And if you hire smarter people than you, then let them get on and keep out of their way as much as possible. It's always my trick. Okay. If you want to get hold of me, my email is martinwu@microsoft.com. You can abuse me on Twitter. I saw some good abuse last night. Thank you very much. So keep it coming, at Martin Woodward. I have the website, which I don't post as much as I used to, because Twitter kind of takes that itch away from me a bit nowadays. And if you get really into your TFS, really, you know, hardcore, nerdy T Foundation server, then come along and listen to the Radio TFS podcast. We've got two in the can. I keep forgetting to publish them. I'll publish one tonight. How about that? There you go. There's an incentive. I've been involved in a few books. Not that that makes me particularly clever or an expert. It just means I know some clever people, a bit like Nino. There's the latest 2013 books. Apologies if people ask questions and I say go buy the book. That's not because I'm trying to sell the book. That's just because I know what's in the book. I work on the Visual Studio team. I live in sunny Northern Ireland, not very far away from here. It always rains in Northern Ireland, so we get nice rainbows. That's the view from my office, which is quite nice. And my team are based in North Carolina and in Redmond. So I work remote, which is exciting. Very remote, as it happens. But now, all this wouldn't be possible without the joys of Link. Link's quite an interesting psychological study. Most of the people I work with have only ever really met me on Link or watched videos of me. So it leads to certain interesting problems. I like to go and see the team fairly often, but there's been a couple of people I worked with for 18 months and had never met. And I walked into the conference room, and there was this guy about Christian's height in the room, and just his face fell. He looked, you know, visibly disappointed. It's not a good start to a meeting. Now, luckily, I work with developers. You know, my customers are developers. The people I work with are developers. That's great, because developers lack all social filters. So I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "You're not as tall as I expected." And that's because in Link, he's very tall. He's used to looking at me at eye level. And the fact I was now having to look down was quite... But all this wouldn't be possible without the vast array of submarine cables that exist under the Atlantic that connect Europe to America and that now circle the world in fiber optic cables and light. The amount of bandwidth available over, you know, across the world through these submarine cables is still growing exponentially and shows no sign of slowing down. That's the current submarine cable map from 2005. You can go to the website here and go browse it if you wish. This is the fancy version. But this is all a precursor. This is all based on something. We talk about Team Foundation Server's 10th anniversary, kind of. It's also the 150th anniversary this year of the beginnings of this network. And there's the beginnings of this network. Does anybody know what this is? This is the telegraph system. So 150 years this year, we started laying telegraph line across the sea, the first submarine cables, between Valenta Bay in Ireland and Newfoundland was when that happened, 250 years ago this year. And even in, this is taken from a newspaper in 1865, even then they were starting to talk about a revolutionary new communication network that would span the entire globe. And you see these dotted lines are kind of what they're hoping to get plumbed in, but these lines already exist all the way across the globe. In 1865, you've got to remember, this is the American Civil War. Abraham Lincoln is the first president ever to be a commander-in-chief and control troops on the front line, the electronic means, the telegraph. And that was all happening around 150 years ago. Now, interestingly, the telegraph itself, the submarine telegraph, that all came about, sorry, the submarine telegraph getting across here is a 3,500-mile span, 5,500 kilometers. To do this was the moonshot of the Victorian era. It's, you know, it was just, they didn't understand how electricity works right now, you know? The technology just didn't exist. They just didn't know what to do. But they've got the financial markets of New York in the New World and the financial markets of the Old World in London, and they knew they wanted to connect them together because they could make money. If you want to read a book about the extremes we will go to make more money with communication networks, read a book called Flash Boys, which talks about the microwave communication towers between Chicago and New York and high-frequency trading. It's a fascinating book. But yeah, in the Victorian era, we needed to do this. We needed to figure out how to connect these two markets. And a key man was pivotal in all this, who's a bit of a hero of mine. He's also the father of application lifecycle management, we like to say. And he's also from Belfast in Northern Ireland. And that's William Thompson, who then became Lord Kelvin. So the Kelvin scale, absolute zero. This is the guy who was behind the whole Atlantic telegraph. We say he's the father of ALM because he has some classic quotes, some classic pearls of wisdom. For example, to measure is to learn. Even in 1865, he was doing build, measure, learn, which is exciting. This is a picture of Lord Kelvin I have on my desk at home. And this is kind of, when you think of people in the Victorian era, this is kind of the people you see, old guys with beards and, you know, dusty costumes and things. But you've got to remember, this is him in his final lecture as he's about to retire. This is him after he's made his name and his fortune helping the British Empire circle the globe and keep control of all that work, and he's been made a lord. This isn't him when he's doing the Atlantic Telegraph and all those achievements. Back then, engineering was the kind of the dot-com of the Victorian age, you know? It's where all the cool kids got into and all the really ambitious 20, 30-year-olds used to go into. So this is a picture Lord Kelvin likes to use. This is him as he's building the Atlantic Telegraph. And he's our age. Okay, he's got a nice suit and a nice dapper cravat and some good sideburns. But, you know, he's a young guy working away, trying to figure out how do we do this? How do we deliver this thing which feels impossible to connect the old and the new world? So they had some ideas. Kind of the first idea when they were thinking about this was to take in small steps. So do an inland route over here, go across the Labrador Sea to Greenland, which it's not very green if anyone's thrown over it. Go over to Reykjavik, which, interesting story about Iceland. It used to be considered unpatriotic to drink beer in Iceland. So, hey, who wants to go there? And then come down through the Shetlands into Scotland and then back to London. So that was one route. Problem is, there's some very deep sea here and it's very cold, lots of ice. And who wants to sit in a little repeater station all the way up there trying to repeat messages? Not good. Another route, which the guys who had French connections proposed, was, hey, how about we take a cable and we route it to the Azores and then we bring it up here into the Bay of Biscay and up to Paris, and then we'll hop across the existing channel telegraph link. That was one route. The route that won, for interesting reasons, is to do an inland section over to Newfoundland and then an underwater section over to Ireland and then hook into the existing telegraph network. So why did this option win? Well, one option was emotional. Cyrus Fields, who was the main financial guy behind the Atlantic Telegraph, he was a big Anglophile. He liked England, so he kind of, that was, there was the emotional aspect. But also there was the political. You know, they wanted to make sure it was a good alliance between the US and the UK, and that in times of war between the US and the UK, they were worried about that happening, and they didn't want communication links to be cut off. So they wanted to have a hotline between the two heads of state of the UK and the US so they could talk. Because the UK were thinking, hey, these Americans might be important one day. You know, we better keep on their good side. And there was another important reason. All this network already existed, and by coming into Ireland, they could hook into the existing infrastructure that already existed from the UK. The US had massive transcontinental telegraphic links already. They had links down into Washington. They had links all the way down into New Orleans. But still, until the Atlantic Telegraph was built, to get a message from London down to New York and back again took a minimum of 40 days. Okay? 40 days. So what they wanted to do is, if we build the inland section here, start building this, what they can actually do is they can be agile. As they go along, they can make incremental improvements. So as they're building the inland network, there's already basically a conveyor belt of ships going back and forth across the Atlantic. And what they would do is they would get fast steamers and they would drive, you know, they'd sail out from here, meet up with ships that were already crossing the Atlantic and exchange messages. And that cut the time to get a message from London to New York by 14 days. So that was a huge improvement. That was a huge, you know, let's do 20% of the work and get a huge amount of return from that. So that was great. And it allowed them to be iterative and incremental. And that iterative, incremental approach had to carry on through the whole project. In 1858, they finally got the money together and built the first transatlantic link between Ireland and New York and Newfoundland. And there's a picture of the cable there. I actually have a piece of this cable at home. I had to try and explain to my wife why I wanted to buy a piece of rusty wire that was 150 years old, but never mind. it was an interesting conversation. That's what it is. So we have the transatlantic link. The reason why, again, this was chosen, at the time, they didn't even know what the oceans were. They'd never explored the oceans. So they sent boats out and took soundings, and they found that the bit of land between Newfoundland and Ireland is actually perfect for laying cables across, which is why it's still used today, because it's flat, it's sandy, there's no major volcanic things there. It's just perfect. So that's what they did. Now, the first time they did it in 1858, you know, big private finance initiatives, governments and politicians like to get involved. So it became a bit of a thing. The British sent one of their best warships and the US sent one of their best warships. You know, there was a bit of discussion about the best way of laying cable. So they decided to take the two ships, because no one ship could carry all that cable, take the two ships, meet in the middle of the Atlantic, kind of tie the cable together, and then set off in opposite directions. Now, obviously, that didn't go very well to begin with. You know, it's kind of crazy. And they would set off, and then one boat would, like, lose a bit of a cable or get stuck, and, you know, you can imagine trying to pull this piece of cable from both ends. It's not great teamwork. But they did it. They managed to get across and lay the cable. And once it was laid, they sent a message from Queen Victoria to the president, and that message, the first message that they sent across that cable, took 17 hours to transmit. Now, the papers of the day were discussing why it took 17 hours to transmit this message. There was quite a lot of speculation. It's funny, if you read the Times in the following weeks, there's a bit of speculation that maybe there was too much champagne consumed in the opening ceremony, and the people in the cabin weren't of the best state to transmit these messages. But it turns out that there was a fundamental flaw in the cable that they didn't know about. They'd never built this technology before. This is all brand new. The cable itself, the copper core, wasn't of high quality. But also, they fundamentally, at the time, didn't understand how electricity worked. And William Thompson, Lord Kelvin, was only just involved in the project to the side. The main electrician on the project was a good Victorian guy who really didn't understand electricity. And a big cable laid out like this doesn't act like, you know, just a piece of pipe pushing electrons from one end of the Atlantic to the other. It acts like a really big, long capacitor. So to get a message across, what they needed to do, the guy was confused, why isn't this working? They started trying to send a message, and it sort of came through, you know, or didn't come through his clean signals. So if I know what I'll do, I'm British. If I'm having trouble communicating with somebody in a foreign country, I will just shout louder. So that's what he did. He put more electricity, more warp speed into that wire and put thousands of volts of... He had huge batteries built that would put thousands of volts down this wire to try and get more signal and burst the wire, basically, exploded the wire. So they'd built this wire all the way from the UK to America, and because they didn't understand how they worked, they burnt it out within days. Oops. I've had those moments in my career where I've done some things like that, you know, and you... Anyway. So these are the original cables. These are mine. Mine aren't this clean. This is a picture I took in the British Museum. But this is the cable that was sort of carrying across the whole Atlantic. Now, they realized they didn't understand the problem. They realized they needed to go back and learn from what they'd done. So they did. They learned a lot about electricity. They learned a lot about insulation. William Thompson built some great new machinery because he managed to convince people that the way to do message transmission over long distances was to use a small amount of current and have very sensitive measurements. So, but the insulation was also important. This stuff here is called gutta percha. It's the Victorian plastic. They didn't have plastic, so they had to get this black stuff here for insulation. Perfect insulation properties. In fact, so perfect insulation properties that it was still used up until the 50s and 60s to build insulation for wire. This gutta percha is available from one particular type of tree, the gutta percha tree, that grows in one particular island belonging to a British colony, which we refused to let anybody else have access to. And there was one company who had access to all the gutta percha in the world, the Gutta and Percha Company. And they harvested their gutta percha and they sold it and made loads and loads of insulation. And it became the thing to build cables with. So they became the company that made cables because they had the monopoly on the insulation. And that company got so big and so good at making cables that when Marconi came along and invented the wireless, and that started to get used, they had all the money, and then they actually ended up joining with the investing in that technology and became a company you've probably heard of today called Cable and Wireless. So they stem from being the people who had the monopoly on gutta percha. That's where they got all their money from. So they invested in the technology. Also, Isambard Kendall Brunel was building a huge iron boat because he could. It's like when we built dark fiber. We just laid dark fiber across the whole world because we could, and we didn't know what we were going to do with it, but it was a boom time. It's the Victorian dot-com. Oh, let's go build a massive boat. It's iron. Awesome. What are we going to do with it? Turns out it's like no use to anybody, you know. However, it was a massive iron boat, brand new technology coming on stream. It turns out it was the only boat in the world now big enough that could actually carry 3,500 miles of cable. Aha, we thought, let's use that and take the Great Eastern and sail it across the Atlantic and lay out the cable. So that's what they did in 1865. They set off in the Great Eastern, now just one boat. They attached one end to a telegraph station in Valenta, and they set off. As they set off, they continuously tested. They were constantly testing down that same wire. You know, are you there? Are you there? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? The whole time as they were going down the wire. And it's fascinating to try and understand the huge shift that was coming across the world as they were going, as they were making it across the Atlantic. The best way it really hit me was I have some newspapers from the Times and the London Illustrated from the Time in the UK, and I have some newspapers from the Time in the US. In the UK, news of this massive, you know, this moonshot, this private SpaceX, privately funded, amazing marvel of the modern age, was transmitted daily. Everyone was just fascinated with where they got to, how things were going. There were plates of people laying out cables. You know, it was all amazing stuff. In New York, they didn't even know it had set off yet. Because it takes 40 days to get a message here. Nothing travels faster than this boat that's laying the cable. So they set off, and they go across here, and all the papers are full of, whoa, this is amazing, they're nearly there, you know, it's working. They drop the signal a couple of times, but because they're continuously testing, they could go back and pick up the cable and, you know, just pull it back in, fix the thing that had broken and carry on. So they didn't go the whole way and say, is it working yet? They were continually testing as they were delivering the cable. And then finally, they landed in Newfoundland on a foggy day. Nobody was there to greet them. It's like when you land early on an aeroplane, you know? They were just like, whoa, what's this that's going on? And a cable has arrived, and then massive news spread, and there was huge celebrations. And so there we go. And then once that was done, it cut the time down, you know, to seconds. People were amazed that you could send a message from the UK and get it to the US before the markets had even opened. This was time travel. This, you know, inspired people like H.G. Wells to write books about how you could travel through time because, wow, this is amazing. And what's also fascinating is the bit rates we're talking about here, actually, on the cable. The original 1858 cable had a bit rate of 1.2 bits per second is what it translated as. The bit rate by when they first laid it was around 10 bits per second, and then it only got up to 12 bits per second by the 1900s. You know, it was slow growth in how quickly they could get the cable to work. It had to be quite slow. But things have gone on a long way. Now, of course, you lay a massive new communications technology across the world, spend millions of pounds doing this, you know, invest in huge technology. What's the first thing you do with that cable? You use it for online gaming, of course. So the Victorians set up a chess match between the Houses of Parliament and the House of Congress in America, and they did it across the telegraph, and it again was carried in the news as this amazing feat of modern gaming. The Americans won, which again confused the British. They think, we better watch out with these Americans. They might get good. So these guys were living on the edge of chaos. They were using technology that had never been done before. They were inventing the technology as they went along. They didn't know what the requirements were for the insulation, for the cables. This was all new. So they had to build things iteratively. They had to continuously test. They had to continuously adapt. And that's where we live today. We live deliberately in this boundary here. If you're doing solutions for your customers that are simple and are well known, why are you building them something? Why aren't you just buying something off the shelf, you know? If you have no idea what you're supposed to be delivering and you're using technology you've got nothing about, then good luck. So you've got to try and live as close to that boundary as possible to deliver value to the business. And that's what we do when we're trying to deliver on a cloud cadence. We were the most waterfall product you could think of, apart from maybe a telegraph across the whole ocean, you know? We were a box product that shipped once every 2 years, roughly. Sometimes it took longer, between 2005, 2008, for example. But we tried to aim to be roughly every 2 years we would ship a product. And we would break that delivery cycle up into a planning section where we would go build some, you know, screenshots and go talk about some stuff and show customers and see what did you think. And we had to get very detailed on our plans because it was important that our plans were 100% correct because we know we needed to, you know, spec everything out because we know we had a whole 2 years ahead of us before we could actually have anything in customers' hands. We had to be right, and we had to also predict where the market was going to be in 2 years' time. So after our planning stage, you know, we knew everything. We knew exactly what we wanted it to be. We knew that it was right. We'd validated it with customers. So now we set off building it. We break that down into milestone phases. So you'll have still seen some of this kind of terminology leak out from Microsoft, like milestone one, milestone two, RC, these kind of milestones you hear about. So we would split them into a couple of milestones. We would have a beta, and then we, 6 to 9 months later, we would ship. That's kind of how we did things. And so we knew we had the schedule. We knew we had to hit that schedule because that's when we go into market. We'd put a whole lot of things in place, like book conferences and, book loads of adverts in papers and start spinning up manufacturing plants to plant, to start printing DVDs and things. We would get all that in place and we'd have the schedule that we had to stick to. So then we would start coding. And we would have a code phase and a test and stabilization phase. Notice the code phase was smaller than the testing and stabilization phase. But we've got perfect estimates, so that's fine. We know exactly what we're going to do. We know how long it's going to take us, so we'll just divide that work up. We'll split that work between as many people as we've got, and we know we'll be fine. We'll get to code complete, and then we'll start testing and stabilizing. But the code was written months before we shipped. Then we would stabilize. When I came to Microsoft, this period here could last about six, nine months, which used to drive me mad. Like, the coding period for a release could be sort of 6 weeks, and then you'd have months-long testing and stabilization. So that just doesn't make sense. What's going on here? And it turns out that what actually happens was people just throw the features in. They would just throw the code in. Who cares if it works? I need the feature in because I'm going to get to this point and I'm not going to have any time left to code. So I need to play a game with the people who look after the system and class it as a bug fix or a change request, So they would just get all the stuff in, know it's not working, just throw it all in, and then they would go through a test and stabilization period when actually they were still really working on the code and just, trying to get it working. It was kind of, they were lying to themselves. So what are the problems? We built up massive bug debts. We'd have huge weeks and weeks where teams would just be bug fixing because they chucked in a bunch of code and didn't integrate it and didn't know if it worked. Once we'd started on the plan's fairly rigid, and if there was a huge major industry change coming along, then we'd have to wait to the next major planning period before we could really pick up and start reacting to it because, we've got no room left in the schedule. We don't know what we can't get rid of anything. And like the Atlantic Telegraph of 1858, success was a one-time shot. And teams were very, very much kind of driven top-down, command and control, told what to do. So how did it work? Well, Microsoft made quite a bit of money delivering software this way, so don't get me wrong, it's a good model for the era, but times have changed. We have to move faster. So we decided to go agile. We have some guiding principles we have in the team around role structure, and we'll cover some of these and schedule and cadence. We give the teams, we make sure they align on the common things, the interface points, so what roles there are, how they're kind of structured. The sprint schedule. The sprint schedule was actually something originally we allowed teams to have autonomy over, to decide themselves. And we found it was leading to communication problems between teams, because one team would be on sprint red, and another team would be on sprint 76 alpha. And nobody really knew where they were. If you were trying to get something done from another team, they were always in a different point in the life cycle. And you get those circular dependencies in software projects where you're dependent on something who's dependent on somebody who's dependent on you. And if you have those circular dependencies and you're not on the same sprint schedules, you just get waste in between. It's like sectors of a disk. You get little gaps that are missing. And so by aligning sprint schedule, we found we became much more efficient across the whole team. But we give the teams themselves complete autonomy over how they plan, over what they plan to do, over what work the team are going to do. They sign up for the work. They believe in the work. They drive the work that team is going to do. And the team are also free to run their teams how they want. We expect certain deliverables from them, which we'll talk about. But if they want to run their team using, whatever kind of mechanism, the fancy latest, name your you know, hot trend of the day kind of methodology, then they can drive their team that way. It's all up to how the team want to work. The key reason why we went around this was some insight. Dan Pink in the Drive book or video actually sums this up quite well, is that software is a creative act. Building software is a creative act. The things we do, it's creative thought. It's not a purely, you know, making sausage thought. It's not engineering. There is an element of creativity in it. And creative teams work best when they're given a sense of autonomy, mastery, and purpose again. So we've watched that video and learned more about some of the insights behind it. So the structure we have in place is that we have 3-week sprints, a 6-month season, and then we think of our vision, the long-term plan, over 18 months. We talked a little about this with Munil, but just to say, we've got two roles, program manager and engineering. We build a team, we assemble those roles together. So we bring the team together. And you can think of this as bringing the customers with the developers sometimes, because the program managers, you know, kind of act as proxy customers. And then they bring them together in a team. The team's across discipline, but it's a pizza team, you know, 6 to 12 people kind of thing. They're completely self-managing. And we keep the team intact, because teams go through the whole storming, norming, forming phases, you know. We keep the team together because they all know each other, they know their strengths and weaknesses, but we regularly change what they work on. We'll regularly say, hey, that's great, you've done a great job there. I need you, you're our expert A team, I need you to go work on this area now for me. And we regularly do that to people, but we keep the team together because the team know each other and have learned how to work well together. And we try where possible to locate them in a physical team room. We completely reorganized our entire, you know, office space to allow for team rooms. This was a huge cultural change in Microsoft, where everyone had their own offices and cubicles. And the more senior you were, the more likely you were to have a window. Or, you know, if you're a VP, you get this massive corner office with your own little conference room and coffee machine and things. It's awesome. This is why, again, I was incredibly proud and impressed to work for Microsoft, because when we went to team rooms, the people that had the most to lose giving up their fancy corner office, giving up their window, they were the people that were actually driving us to working more agile. You know, they were getting the teams to try and work this way. And I just love this environment. It's brilliant. Everybody's around, you know. But because we're now in team rooms together, we still have all this same office space, so we've got space around the team rooms for, you know, individual drop-in meeting rooms and larger meeting rooms. So if you want to go have a quiet conversation, you can. If you want to go make a phone call, you can. If you want to get together, you can. And so there's so many more meeting rooms available now for quick ad hoc discussions that before just couldn't happen because we were so wasteful of space. I'm a remote employee. You might have noticed what happens. We do have remote employees, but we're very much the exception. You have to be an odd person to work well as a remote team. You have to have a curious mix of kind of introverted get on and do things and not get distracted, and then enjoy talking to people. It's, you know, because you have to be very communicative. So it is the exception rather than the rule. We try to have remote teams. We try and center the team roughly together and have those guys work together as a unit rather than have too many remote individuals. It's very easy as a remote individual to get disconnected from the team if you're not careful. And also as a manager of remote people, it's often hard to detect if there are any problems. You know, if somebody's struggling or starting to thrash, that can be difficult to see. So that's why we try and keep people together. So we do 3-week sprints. That's a sprint schedule we aligned on. During the 3-week sprint, we have the sprint plan, which goes out in an email message, and then we have a sprint, what we accomplished, and a video. The video has some rules. Number one, no production value at all. When we started doing sprint videos, people would do credits, they would do music. It was like watching the Star Wars trailer for everybody. People spent too much time on their sprint videos and not enough time on the code in the video. No production value. It should be the same as walking up to a colleague and saying, hey, what have you been working on? You know, and them giving you an over-the-shoulder demo, just showing some stuff. There's no accelerated time sequences. You're not allowed to make cuts, you know, and go, I'm just going to create a team project. Cut for 5 hours. Team project created. You know, you have to show it live. Again, if you can't show a feature in the 5 minutes you aim to do a video in, then in 3 weeks, you can't show it in 5 minutes. What's going on? It's either too slow or it's too complicated. So we, and no production value, no accelerated time sequences, and it has to be available to everybody to be able to see. And I mean everybody. Everybody in the team gets access to this. All our partner teams get access to this. My boss, Brian Harry, has a habit of sharing them with the field and MVPs from time to time and not telling me. It's great. They should be viewable to everybody inside the company. It's all NDA material. And as an example of some sprint videos, I've actually got a video with me that we'll play at the end if we get time from one of my features that I delivered. And then there we go. Are they real sprints? Well, we did that kind of work before in terms of building up debt and then bringing debt back down again. And we actually, yes, these are real sprints. We have a single definition of done, which makes sure we're not accruing too much bug debt. Things are working. Things are potentially shippable. And in fact, with Visual Studio Online and Visual Studio, things are shipped every sprint. You know, we ship CTPs. We ship a new release to the service. We ship every sprint. We don't track burn down. As a management organization, we don't look at the burn down of individual teams. How the team want to run themselves is up to the team. There are things we do track, though. What bugs they have, what coverage they have, what their build quality's been like. More importantly, who's using the feature in the real world? Is it getting adoption? You know, if not, then why are we investing in it? What's the feedback like that's coming back from the community? All those are important things. How you run your team, what your estimates were like, what your original estimates compared to your actual estimates. I don't care. I just care what you deliver and what gets to customers and the customers enjoying it and using it. So then we look at the six-month season. So we break up the calendar into very American spring and fall. And then we take the sprints and within three sprints, we have a team chat. And again, a team chat rules are, it's very informal, even though it's with leadership, it's very informal, no amazingly shiny, fancy decks. You know, if you've got anything like a slide animation in, it's kind of looked down on. You talk about what's next on your backlog for the next three sprints. And typically it's, this is what I'm going to work on next sprint. I know that in a lot of detail. This is what I think we're going to work on in the sprint after that, depending on how much we get done in the next sprint. And then this is roughly where I think we're going in the third sprint. You know, and there's the further out you get, the lower detail is expected of your plans. And then you talk about your debt situation. And you also talk about any issues you've got that you need to bring to management. Like, hey, we really need this feature if we're going to deliver this, but it's gone down the priority of this other team. Therefore, I need you to fix that. Otherwise, this isn't going to happen. Or, you know, we've got some risk here. You bring those issues up to management. And management also makes sure that teams are communicating with each other. Did you know such and such is building this? Oh, no, I didn't. I better go talk to those guys. You know, so they make sure that there is communication between teams. The sprint emails help for that because I just tend to watch the email videos and see and go, oh, I didn't even realize you were working on that. Let's talk. But the management chats also help. And the chats are always direct with senior leadership. As Munil mentioned, we kind of got rid of a middle management tier. And so we go direct to leadership, each of the teams. We bring everybody in to the meeting. It's one of the few big, like, two-hour epic meetings that I have to attend, but it's once every 3 weeks. And I only have to attend it for my personal 15 minutes of that meeting. You know, it's the managers that have to sit there, the Sam and Brian and Laurie and people like that who have to sit there for the full 2 hours and listen to everybody. So it goes direct. So that's okay for like individual delivery, but it's very easy to get lost in the trees, you know, to look at the focus on the detail. You need to keep looking up and think about, does a whole experience make sense? So we do experience reviews as well. An experience review is what you are going to build as an end-to-end story, how it makes sense, where it fits in with other parts of the system as they're coming along. And again, you talk about how you're going to be delivering in terms of we're going to work on this, the first sprint, then this. You're not talking about broken down into individual tasks. And the experience reviews are all about getting feedback from the rest of the team and from everybody running the team and helping them. You know, is this the right thing that you want us to go focus on next? But it's the team saying, this is what we are thinking we are focusing on next. Can you validate that? And then finally, we have the longer term planning. It's all very well. You need to keep looking at the horizon. So we do scenario reviews that take a broad scenario of product of features and actually make sure, again, that we're delivering the individual experiences to make that scenario make sense, like open ALM scenario, you know, those sorts of things. We do that every season. So after the end of a season, we will replan our vision, where we're heading. So we're constantly trying to look out 18 months to see where we're heading to make sure that we're going in the right direction. You know, we don't just have a plan and leave it on a shelf. It's being constantly refreshed and constantly updated. And so then we learn and we replan. So that's how we're getting on as an organization. What's next? As Manil mentioned, we're becoming a much more data-informed business. We're getting much more into, you know, making sure we make our decisions based on real-world facts and less, you know, try to take the gut feel out of it, try to make it more scientific. To measure is to learn. And we also, obviously, getting into making sure we continuously do everything. Rather than being very sprint-focused, you know, very chunk, we're trying to get closer to the curve and actually have the smoother curve, so we're constantly delivering value, constantly getting things out there, and, you know, constantly delivering value to our customers. We're also doing cool things in terms of getting better at running a service all the time, you know. The way that we do security and things is massively, you know, security is very important in Microsoft and something that we worry a lot about, and just doing exercises in terms of, you know, hardening of the service and making sure we try and hack our own service and things like that is all things we're trying to just do to get better as a product group. So the key takeaways, less process is more. Try to do what you can with your team to give them the guidance, to give them the predictability and the structure, and then try and keep out their way. If you've hired good people, they should do good things for you. Provided they have the common structure to build on. Give your teams a sense of autonomy, keep learning, keep planning, and keep having fun. Now, I'd like to leave you with one last quote from my hero, Lord Kelvin. To measure is to learn, but also to live amongst friends is the primary source of happiness. I'd say yesterday, we're very, very lucky as a product group to have such frankly, cool customers who are actually smarter than us, so that's awesome. So, thank you very much for all of the feedback you give us. Thank you very much for the very open dialogues we have, and please keep it coming. It's just the best team to work in and the best area to work on, so thank you very much. If anybody's interested, there's the cable book, and then as the recording's now finished, let's quickly show you some NDA stuff, shall we? So this is an example of an experience review that I did. If you've used Visual Studio Online, you notice that you have all the code comments in there now. This was the experience review for code comments, and it was deliberately built as a thing that built up to pull requests. Notice code comments landed in 2013 and pull requests has only just landed now. So this was, you know, an experience that didn't get completed within TFS 2013, but this was the idea all along. And so they're kind of explaining what we're doing, kind of explaining the high-level concepts that we're introducing, and then showing the experience how it's going to work. So, you know, some little features, you know, we're going to have these kind of things. And this is some elements of the interface that we're thinking of building, kind of explaining how we want it to work, and we wanted it to be super lightweight. There was lots of debate over what we should call a links undo save. Should you make it auto save after you click? Should you enable keyboard shortcuts like escape? All these types of things are all things we spent far too much time worrying about. But you know when you've done a feature right, when the interface kind of just disappears from the user and you don't notice any of those bits of code? This is showing you how you go in, add a comment. And this is kind of, if you see these storyboards, this isn't exactly how the feature landed because we constantly iterate. We build the code and we work on it and we see how it goes. But this is how we constantly, you know, deliver it. But it's roughly like this. You can go create work items. That wasn't there in the first release of the feature. We actually added that a bit later, but it was in the original vision. And there's probably stuff in here that still isn't delivered, but was in my original vision. But never mind, we'll get there. There you go. Ensure emails and team room alerts have the link into review. I don't think we've quite done that bit yet, for example, but we're getting there. And then this was talking about where, you know, code reviews and pull requests and how pull requests were going to work, the rough implementation plan. And you can see we planned on doing pull requests later than everything else. And you can see kind of, you know, the sprints early on, it's a very detailed breakdown of work. But then as you get further on down, it's kind of, we're going to build pull requests. We don't really know what it's going to look like yet. It's going to kind of do this, and we know we need all this stuff first. So let's go build all this stuff first. So that's an example of an experience review. And then quickly, I just stuck two sprint videos together here, but just to show you what a sprint video looks like. As I say, absolutely no production value, so it's just me chatting away. This is showing some Eclipse feature here. I'm showing about how we get connected to Git, and it's no accelerated time sequences. I'm accelerating it for you now, but you just go through and you just kind of explain some things. This is me. I think I'm showing how to connect to a Git repository here, if I remember rightly. But it was kind of showing the new Team Explorer look and feel in Eclipse. And then this is another sprint review of me showing the first iteration of the web code review, the web commenting feature and all that sort of thing. So this little stuff I was insanely proud of, being a program manager, you spend far too much time worrying about. For example, when you add a comment, you'll notice, you see that you probably don't even see it, even if you use the system. The arrow of the comment points to the middle of the selection box of the thing that you're commenting to. I was insistent on that detail. That was important to me. I even gave him the math to make that happen, I know I'm doing a good job when there's math involved. That's the best kind of program management. So that's kind of what sprint videos look like. And to be honest, these are the main, I don't read the emails that come out much because, there's lots of, I watch the video and then if I need to, I'll go into the email and drill down into the stories because all this, you get links to all their work items in TFS. You can go drill into more detail and see exactly what they mean. So there we go. Okay, hope that was useful. Thank you very much for your time and have a great day.